The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're doing a deep dive into a really fascinating book, Marilynne Robinson's Reading Genesis. It basically tries to rescue one of the most foundational texts in Western culture.
Yeah, foundational and, let's be honest, often weaponized. Genesis gets viewed through these really narrow lenses, doesn't it?
Totally. Either it's like super rigid literalism that just flattens everything out.
Or it's this sort of cynical dismissal. You know, people see it as just primitive history about a, frankly, cruel and unpredictable God.
Right. So our goal today is to kind of cut through that noise. Robinson poses this huge question. What if all that misinterpretation from both sides has hidden the real picture? What if the God in Genesis is actually defined by, well, overwhelming benevolence, by grace?
It's a big what if. And for anyone listening who thinks they know these Old Testament stories, this book offers some genuinely radical aha moments. You really have to shed some old assumptions.
So why does this matter now?
Well, Robinson is tackling what she sees as a kind of crisis in biblical literacy today. She argues that if you actually read Genesis carefully, as the sophisticated literature it is, it offers these incredibly deep insights.
Insights into what, exactly?
Into consciousness, into morality, how we deal with freedom, with failure. I mean, really fundamental human stuff. And she thinks these insights go way beyond just religious circles.
Okay, so who is Marilynne Robinson? What gives her the standing to offer this kind of revolutionary take?
Well, first off, she's one of America's absolute top contemporary writers, a novelist, an essayist, Pulitzer Prize winner for Gilead. Maybe you've read that, part of that amazing quartet of novels.
Right, incredible writer. So she comes at it as a literary expert.
Exactly, that's key. She reads Genesis like a master novelist would. She's not primarily a historian trying to date things or check facts. She's looking at character, narrative structure, the subtle meanings in the language itself.
She sees the art in it.
Precisely. Where maybe others just see, you know, archaic rules or confusing stories.
Yeah.
But there's another layer too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. She's not just treating it as literature. There's a real spiritual depth there.
For sure.
Yeah.
She's also a very learned lay theologian, deeply read in figures like John Calvin, other Protestant thinkers. And it's this combination, this synthesis.
Literary artistry and theological knowledge.
Yeah. That's what lets her get beyond the simple, is it literally true or is it just fiction? Kind of debate.
Yeah.
She takes both the literary side and the spiritual side seriously. That's how she unlocks these deeper layers of meaning.
Okay, so let's talk about the book itself, Reading Genesis. What's the core project here?
So the book is essentially this really sustained, very patient, and actually quite appreciative, close reading. She reads Genesis as one whole unified piece of work.
Right. And it's important to get her method. It's not a verse-by-verse commentary, is it? Or like a historical debunking.
No, not at all. The goal is different. She's inviting you, the reader, to just slow down, to try and shed some of those modern biases we bring to it.
Like expecting it to be a science textbook or a straightforward moral rule book.
Exactly. It's a 3,000-year-old text. It operates differently. Her central argument, her thesis, is that the main story arc of Genesis is really about divine grace, about faithfulness.
And that faithfulness is expressed through this idea of covenant.
Yes, the covenant is huge for her. And this reframing, seeing grace as the driving force, immediately changes how she approaches those really difficult parts.
The ones everyone points to, like the fall, the flood, Abraham being asked to sacrifice Isaac.
Right. She insists you have to read those moments through this lens of God's fundamental, unwavering goodness. Otherwise, you miss the point.
Okay. So what are the theological building blocks she focuses on?
Well, a major one is the status of humanity, this idea of being created in the image of God, the Imago Dei. For Robinson, this isn't just a phrase. It's foundational.
Foundational in a way.
It endows humans with this radical dignity, with consciousness, with immense value, and importantly, with moral freedom.
And the other big piece is covenant, which you mentioned. How does she see that differently?
She really hammers this point home. God's covenants, like the one with Noah after the flood or with Abraham, these are not contracts. They aren't transactional. Like, if you do this, then I'll do that.
Which is often how we think of them, right?
Totally. But she argues they are unilateral promises.
Yeah.
God basically binds himself to humanity out of pure generosity. It's not based on human merit or performance.
So it's more like a parent's promise to a child. Their commitment holds even if the child messes up.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah. And that distinction, it completely changes the relationship dynamic. It shifts it away from sort of performance anxiety.
To trust in God's faithfulness.
Exactly. Rooted in trust.
Okay, that's a really helpful framework. Now, let's dive into some of the specific stories where her reading really makes you rethink things. Starting with the big one, the fall, Genesis 3.
Right, the classic reading. Adam and Eve disobey, eat the fruit, get punished, kicked out of Eden. Simple.
But Robinson sees it very differently.
Oh, completely. She challenges that punitive reading straight away. For her, eating the fruit isn't just petty disobedience. It's a tragic, yes, but also somehow necessary awakening.
Necessary. Oh.
It's the moment humanity gets a conscience. Moral awareness. Mm-hmm. The knowledge of good and evil. And, you know, that's arguably what makes us fully human, that capacity to grapple with morality.
So if it's an awakening, then the expulsion from Eden, it's not just an angry God throwing them out.
She reads it primarily as a consequence, but a protective one. God shields them from the tree of life. Why? To prevent them from living forever in this new fallen state of suffering.
Imagine immortal suffering.
Okay, yeah, that's a different angle. And that final detail, God clothing them in animal skins. Robinson sees that as an act of profound parental tenderness. Covering their shame. It's not about rage. It's almost gentle.
Wow. That reframing feels much less like a cosmic courtroom drama and more like, I don't know, deep psychological insight.
Mm-hmm. And then we move forward to Cain and Abel, the first murder. It's brutal.
Yeah. But Robinson points out something crucial before the murder happens, right?
Yes. God actually warns Cain. He says, sin is crouching at your door, but you must rule over it. It highlights human agency. Cain has a choice.
A choice he tragically fails to make.
Exactly. It shows a God who respects our freedom, even when it leads to disaster. And then the most surprising part for many people, the mark of Cain.
Which we usually think of as like a brand of shame, a curse.
But Robinson points to the text. It's described as a divine shield. God protects Cain, the first murderer, from vengeance. It's an incredibly early, profound example of grace tempering justice.
Grace, right there at the start, even for Cain. That's unexpected. But okay. Even if we accept grace for Cain, what about the flood? That seems like the ultimate counterexample to a benevolent God. Total destruction.
It's the biggest challenge to her thesis, no doubt.
Yeah.
And she tackles it head on. She pushes back against the wrathful God caricature by actually looking closely at the language the text uses to describe God's motivation.
And what does the text say?
It describes God as being filled with pain, with grief. Profound sorrow over the state of the world, which the text says was consumed by violence. Ham, the Hebrew word used there.
So the flood isn't driven by arbitrary anger, but by divine heartbreak.
That's her reading. It's presented as this cosmic sorrow. A terrible, yes, but necessary surgery. Her word born out of grief to prevent creation from completely destroying itself through violence.
And immediately after this terrible event
comes the Noahic covenant, the rainbow. This universal, unconditional promise from God never to destroy the world by water again, reinforcing that unilateral commitment.
Okay, that leads us to the Tower of Babel. Another confusing one. If God is good, why confuse everyone and scatter them? Seems counterproductive to unity.
Robinson offers a fascinating interpretation here, too. She argues it wasn't jealousy or pettiness. It was actually God preventing a kind of dangerous totalitarian homogeneity.
Like one language, one power structure, potentially oppressive.
Exactly. By confusing the languages and scattering people, God introduces diversity, plurality, culture. She argues it's for humanity's own good in the long run.
And that scattering is then immediately balanced by a gathering.
Yes. Right after Babel, you get the call of Abraham. Out of all these scattered peoples, God chooses one person, Abraham, and makes this huge, unearned promise. Through him, all nations will eventually be blessed. It's pure grace again.
Which brings us to maybe the most ethically troubling story for modern readers. Abraham being asked to sacrifice Isaac, the Akedah.
It's terrifying. Robinson doesn't try to soften it. She calls it a necessary mystery. Mm-hmm. She doesn't defend it as just, you know, blind obedience is good.
So how does she approach it?
She sees it revealing the absolute priority of God in a life of faith. But crucially, the story's climax is God rejecting human sacrifice. He provides the ram instead.
But the sheer emotional trauma of the demand itself, doesn't that just prove God is capricious or cruel?
Robinson frames it more as a profound test of faith, one that ultimately affirms life and God's provision by intervening. It's about the depth of the covenant relationship, revealing Abraham's commitment, but ending in rescue, not death. It's incredibly complex.
Okay. Then we get into the patriarchs, and God chooses Jacob. Jacob, the guy who tricks his blind father, cheats his brother Esau out of his birthright. He's not exactly a moral role model.
And that's precisely Robinson's point.
Yeah.
The choice of Jacob the trickster proves that God's election, his calling, is a sovereign act of grace. It has nothing to do with moral perfection or deserving it.
It's not earned.
Not at all. And Jacob himself is wounded and transformed through struggle. Remember the wrestling match. He goes from being Jacob, the supplanter, to Israel, one who strives with God. He becomes a model of spiritual struggle emerging from his messiness.
Which leads us, finally, to Joseph. His story feels like the culmination, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Betrayed by his brothers, sold into slavery, falsely accused, imprisoned. I mean, just awful stuff happens to him. Yet in the end, when he has all the power, he forgives them.
And it's Joseph's words that Robinson points to as summing up the whole book's theology.
Yes. He tells his brothers, "Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good." For Robinson, that is the theological thesis statement of Genesis.
Wow. So the idea is that God is sovereign enough, powerful enough, to take even the absolute worst of human actions, jealousy, betrayal, malice, and somehow weave them into his larger redemptive plan.
Exactly. It's the ultimate expression of providence in the book.
Okay, let's try to distill some of the key themes here, the big takeaways people can really hold on to. First, clearly, is this idea of the overwhelming benevolence of God.
Yeah, she relentlessly pushes back against that angry Old Testament God image. The God she finds in Genesis is characterized by generosity, by patience, deep sorrow over sin, yes, but ultimately by unwavering faithfulness.
And thinking about that can really change how you view your own life, right? Your own struggles or failures. Maybe they're met with patience, not just condemnation.
It's a radical shift in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Second big theme, the exalted status of humanity. That Imago Dei idea again.
Being made in God's image.
It's not just a throwaway line. It endows every single human being with this inherent radical dignity, consciousness, value, moral freedom. It forces you to recognize the profound worth of every person. No exceptions.
That challenges any tendency we might have towards, you know, self-deprecation or dismissing other people.
Absolutely. Third key theme. Central to her whole reading, the primacy of the unilateral covenant.
We touched on this. God's promises aren't two-sided contracts based on performance.
Right. They're unconditional. God binds himself to humanity out of grace. So the relationship isn't based on us constantly worrying if we're measuring up. It's based on trusting God's commitment.
Which should theoretically lessen anxiety and foster trust.
That's the idea. And finally, a fourth theme, maybe. Genesis as profound psychological realism. Meaning the characters are complex, they're flawed, they're messy. Jacob the trickster, Joseph's jealous brothers. The narrative shows God's plan unfolding through all this human dysfunction, not somehow separate from it or in spite of it.
So our own messy lives, our own mistakes and complexities, they aren't necessarily obstacles to purpose.
Robinson suggests they might be the very vehicle for it. God works within the real, messy human condition.
It's clear Robinson has this incredible gift for phrasing. Her writing distills these huge theological ideas into really elegant, memorable lines. Let's share a few key ideas we pulled out on the fall, for instance.
Yeah, she says something like, "The fall should not be seen as a petty crime, but as the moment humanity acquired conscience. The knowledge of good and evil is what makes us truly human."
That totally reframes it, doesn't it? Makes it more of a coming-of-age story, less a simple crime and punishment.
Exactly. And on covenants, she's so clear. The covenants God makes are never contracts based on mutual obligation. They are unilateral promises, gifts of pure grace. Just highlights God's generosity and self-binding nature.
And what about dealing with that idea of God's wrath, particularly with the flood?
She directly challenges it, saying something to the effect of, "The frequent complaint that the God of the Old Testament is wrathful ignores the plain language of the text, which repeatedly describes God's grief, his pain, and his profound sorrow."
So judgment, when it comes, stems from divine heartbreak, not just arbitrary anger.
That's her reading, especially for the flood. And then, of course, that core thesis summed up by Joseph. "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good."
Such a powerful distillation. The idea that God's sovereignty can absorb and redirect even the worst human intentions towards an ultimately good end.
It's the bedrock of her understanding of providence in Genesis.
So thinking practically, how can listeners maybe apply some of these ideas from reading Genesis to their own lives?
Well, one obvious way is in reframing personal failures. If God works through flawed people like Jacob, maybe your mistakes don't automatically disqualify you. Maybe they can be part of a larger story too. It encourages, I think, self-compassion, resilience.
Yeah, I can see that. And maybe even in navigating difficult relationships, family conflict.
Definitely. I mean, Genesis is full of raw family drama. Cain and Abel, Jacob and Esau, Joseph and his brothers. But it culminates in Joseph's forgiveness. It offers a model, perhaps, for trying to see harm within a bigger picture. Maybe even finding a path to reconciliation.
That's helpful. What about more intellectually? Any tools we can take away?
I think Robinson's whole method of reading is valuable. That slow, patient, charitable approach. You could apply that to any important text, sacred or secular. It teaches you to look for deeper coherence, for literary richness, instead of just jumping on surface contradictions or easy dismissals.
It's like learning how to read better, essentially.
Exactly. And finally, cultivating that sense of providence, she finds in Genesis that underlying belief that despite the chaos, maybe something good is ultimately being worked out. That can be a powerful antidote to the cynicism and despair that's so easy to fall into today.
Looking for grace, even when things are tough.
Yeah. Finding meaning, even in suffering. It's a profound orientation towards life.
So as we wrap up, what was the biggest surprise or takeaway for you from digging into Robinson's work here?
For me, I think it's the sheer number of moments where she makes you stop and say, wait, I never saw it that way before. Like the mark of Cain being protection, not shame. Or seeing the Babel story as God fostering beneficial diversity. She uses her literary skills to reveal this remarkably coherent, loving, divine character that maybe gets lost in more fragmented readings. It genuinely makes an ancient text feel fresh and intellectually compelling.
Yeah, I agree. It feels like she scrapes away centuries of interpretation to get back to something powerful in the text itself.
My lasting thought is probably about the power of reading generously. Robinson demonstrates that so many of the problems we find in Genesis might actually be problems with our reading, our impatience, our biases, our modern assumptions. By approaching the text with humility, with charity, and with real attention to its literary nature, she restores its intellectual and spiritual coherence in a really convincing way.
A call to read better, perhaps?
Definitely. A call to read with fresh eyes.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.